Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a 94-year-old Native American takes us back to Oahu on December 7th, 1941.
I was on my way to church, and all of a sudden I heard a big noise.
From his memories of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor to the three times he was wounded during World War II, catch his story on Hometown Heroes. Today at 1 on News Talk 580 1059, brought to you by Morrison's RV Parts and Service at 180 and Academy in Sanger.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who, if you take the time to get to know them, you'll hear some incredible stories about the things they've done in the service of our country. We want to honor our veterans for their service, the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, so we don't lose sight of the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're all educated, we're entertained, and a lot of times we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The young man we're going to meet today won't be 95 until February, and I think you'd have a hard time convincing folks at the post in Atwater that he is almost 95 years old. Very young at heart gentleman, Francisco Paredes, or as they know him around here, Frank. Tell me about your life growing up, Mescalero Apache in the Dragoon Mountains of Arizona, and how many brothers and sisters did you have?
I had 8 brothers and 8 sisters. Most of them are gone. I only have 2 sisters left, no brothers.
What's it like to grow up in that big of a family? Because I think most of us don't know what it's like to be one of 16 kids, 4 or 5 maybe, but 16's a lot.
Well, it's kind of hard, you know, because at 16, I worked in the mines in Arizona, and that wasn't for me.
That copper mines or silver mines or what?
Copper mines. So anyway, I got hurt. I was 2,000 feet down a shaft, and I got hurt. And then the company found out that I was underage, so that I wouldn't sue them. They paid me off with $9,000, and that was a lot of money at the time.
Especially for a 16-year-old.
Right. So I got my mom and 2 of my sisters and 1, I guess, would be a niece, and we went to Mexico. This is my some other family down there. You know, we stayed down there for about maybe 2 weeks. Then I came back, and then I told Mom, I says, let's go to California. She said, what are you going to do in California? I says, sell everything you have, and we'll find you a place in California for you. So I did, you know, and we moved back to California. To Monterey, California. We stayed there for about maybe a year, and then she wanted to go back to Arizona. So I took her back, and then the second time when I brought her, I said, Mom, I says, I came after you. I want to take you to California. I'm going to set you up. Here's the bad news. I'm going to join the military. That's what I want to do. I was about 20 years old. So she said, okay, we'll go to California. So I got her set up. So I joined a tuna fishing fleet, albacore tuna, in South America, in Peru. So I did that, and I came back with a pretty good chunk of money. So then I told her, I said, okay, Mom, I says, this is the deal. I'm setting you up. Now here's the bad news. I'm going to join the military. So that's when I did. That was in September the 16th of 1941. I had to find something for me to do, something to be helpful. So that's what I did. I joined the military. They sent me to Hawaii. I was on my way to Manila to join the troops in Manila. So I was waiting in Pearl Harbor, Schofield Barracks actually, on a cadre to go, waiting for more people to show up to go to Manila. But that's when I got caught, you know. incidentally, a friend of mine, his name was Max Druin. He passed away about 6-7 months ago. He went in the Navy, and I went in the Army. He was aboard the USS West Virginia. I was in Schofield Barracks. So on Saturday night, December the 6th, I went to Pearl Harbor to visit with him. And we had a few beers, you know, and chatted, you know, about the hometown and this and that. I told Max, I says, I got to catch the last shuttle to Schofield Barracks. Otherwise, I'll be stranded here, you know. And I do help the priest say Mass on Sunday mornings. So I caught my shuttle, went back, and I made it okay. 8 o'clock, about 8:05, I was on my way to church for Mass. And all of a sudden, I heard a big noise, and the sirens went off. And they says, this is not a drill. This is not a drill. All personnel report to your stations. I didn't have a station, but we did have machine guns set up, you know. So what I did, I manned the first machine gun that I could find, and it was a Twin 50 on a Heinz mount. I spotted this torpedo bomber. He was probably about maybe 150, 200 feet up in the air. I could see the pilot, and I took a burst at him, and I missed him. Then I gave him a lead, and then I took another burst at him, and I smoked him. I don't know whether he went down, but I'm pretty sure he did went down because he started going towards the ocean. So that's when everything went haywire. So I started picking up, fighting fires, helping out, you know, with whatever I did. And I helped for about maybe 7 or 8 days. And then I got on, they put me on a ship, and I was on my way to Australia.
Well, let me come back to that, because I want to, before we get too far past it, I want to ask you about that time on Oahu, because you described it, and I know you lived it, and you probably tell these stories a few times, but you're a 21-year-old kid, you're on your way to Mass, and all of a sudden, World War II begins for America, and you're right there in the thick of it, and you hop on a machine gun and shoot a Japanese plane. What did this feel like? Because I imagine that's a pretty big shock to your system, that all of a sudden you're at war and the world is crazy. How did you deal with that?
I know it was crazy. So I joined the military for one thing and one thing only, to do what I had to do for my country. And that's what I did.
Was it scary for you in that moment? I mean, this is day one. I mean, you knew maybe something was going to happen at some point, but now it's actually here right in your face.
Yeah, it was scary. But the way I figured, you live at one day at a time. And that's the way it went, you know, all through my military life.
And you said you were helping out for 7 or 8 days in the aftermath of the Japanese attack. And there aren't a whole lot of people left with us anymore that actually saw those things with their own two eyes. What are some of the things that you saw and experienced in those days following the attack that you still remember today, that in when you close your eyes, you can still picture exactly what that looked like?
Well, to me, you know, I still have dreams about that. And those dreams, you know, make you, to me, they make you go on and on, live your life as you want to live it.
Were you around Schofield Barracks cleaning up, or did you go down to the harbor and help with pulling bodies out of the water and all that?
Yes, I went to, I started pulling bodies, limbs, you know, arms, legs, you know, and heads, and it was awful. Thinking about it, you know, it makes me cry. The poor people, innocent people that got caught in a turmoil like that.
And I know there are other moments, because this is just the start of the war and you were in for a while, but when you think back specifically about December 7th, is there part of you that says, yeah, I could have been one of those more than 2,000 that died there?
Yes, I lost a few friends. I lost, especially in Schofield Barracks, I lost a few friends there. And then aboard the USS Arizona, I lost a cousin. His name was William Webb. So when I went back to Pearl Harbor in 1990, I went to the memorial, and there was Japanese people going to the USS Arizona, and they were speaking in Japanese. and they were descendants of the pilots that had bombed Pearl Harbor because, you know, I had a lot of Japanese friends here before the war, and I learned a little bit about Japanese, you know. I could understand some of it, but not all of it. But they had, you know, people there too, you know, wanted to go see the memorial. And then the memorial, you could still see oil coming up. And I think that'll go on forever because there's a lot of people that are buried there, you know, underwater.
Is your cousin one of them?
Yes.
And at the time, back in 1941, I'm sure there was some uncertainty at first. You guys didn't know who had survived, who hadn't. When did you find out that your cousin had died, and what did that do to you?
I found out that when after the war, I went to my cousin's, you know, to his mom, you know, her name was Cleo, Clotilde. She says, I'm very proud of my son. He died a hero. Anyway, that's about all I can remember about him, you know. But getting back to picking up bodies, parts of bodies, taking them, you know, to grave registration. It took a while, you know, to get everything, you know, squared away.
And I know you'd been exposed to a lot through working in the mines and doing your tuna trip to South America and all that. So you'd seen a lot and experienced a lot. But I can't imagine that being easy to see this death and destruction all around you. How did you cope with that? How did you deal with it at the time?
Well, you have to deal with whatever comes along. You have to deal with it, you know, one way or the other. Some people, as a rule, you know, deals like what I went through, they'd go bananas. But I kept my wits, you know, and I'm doing fine as of now, you know. And I'm still doing great.
What's the secret? How do you do that?
You would have to ask me that. I think it's my Indian heritage. As I was growing up, I did a lot of things what the Indians did. And to this day, I still do when I can, you know. Believe it or not, I do powwows at Table Mountain Casino here in California. Once in a while, I go to Window Rock, Arizona, because I had some original code talkers in Window Rock, and they're all buried in Fort Defiance, Arizona. And I go there once in a while. You can't drink Corona there anymore.
When I talk to guys who are at Pearl Harbor, and I talk to guys who just served in the war, period, remember Pearl Harbor. I mean, it was three words that seemed to hold a lot of weight for them. For you, as you go on, and we're going to hear some of your adventures in the rest of the war, how big of a motivation was what you had seen and experienced at Pearl Harbor? What did remember Pearl Harbor mean to you?
It meant to me that remember Pearl Harbor, keep on going and give them hell. And that's what we did.
Well, and we're going to find out how you did that and how close you came to not coming home from the war. Wounded on three separate occasions. 94-year-old Frank Paredes of Atwater, California is our guest. And as we head to our first break, let's listen to a little bit of that song that summed up how so many Americans felt after what happened on December 7th, 1941. Hometown Heroes will be back in a moment after you experience a little bit of the Sammy Kay Orchestra and Remember Pearl Harbor.
Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real a sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 94-year-old World War II veteran Francisco Paredes of Atwater, California. You'll find him most days right where I interviewed him, at the Victor S. Machado VFW Post 9946 in Atwater. It's named for one of the more than 400,000 Americans who did not come home from World War II. Mr. Paredes lost quite a few friends during the war, and as we're about to hear, he had some pretty close calls himself. You can find some photos and video clips at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And before I brought you back to reflect more on Pearl Harbor, you started to share how not long after that you were headed toward Australia. Can we pick it up right there?
But we didn't make it to Australia on account of we didn't have an escort or anything. So we pulled into Auckland, New Zealand. They treated us like kings, you know. And then all of a sudden, we got news that there was a destroyer escort taking us into Australia. So we finally made it to Australia, to Sydney. And then in Sydney, we were stationed at the King's Row Park. Then we were there for about maybe 3 or 4 days, and we got put on a train heading up to Cairns, Australia. That was when the Battle of the Coral Sea was starting to go on. So then after the Battle of the Coral Sea, we weren't getting no supplies. No, the Air Force asked for volunteers, and I volunteered to be a machine gunner on a B-25. And going towards Port Moresby to make a bombing run, we got one of our wings shot off, so we had to bail out. That was my first parachute jump.
So you're in the Army, but you're still not assigned to any division or outfit, right? And they wanted volunteers to go on B-25s?
They needed a gunner. Everything was going to Europe at the start of the war in the Pacific. So Europe was getting all the supplies. And they needed a volunteer gunner. That was the 5th Air Force. So I volunteered. And as we were making our run over Port Moresby, New Guinea, anti-aircraft or guns, you know, started shooting at us. And they blew part of our wing off. So the pilot says, get ready to bail out. I had never bailed out.
Well, you haven't had any aerial training at all, right?
No, I've never had any aerial training at all.
Doesn't that sound a little ridiculous to you?
Right. But, I mean, I enlisted to do what I had to do. Yeah. So I bailed out. Everybody got safe. The plane crashed naturally, you know, because we abandoned the plane. But we landed in the water, and we were there for a couple of hours. But we had Mae West life jackets, and we had a vial that you squeezed it, and they would send out phosphorus. There was a shark repellent. There were sharks there, that is for sure. But in about 2 hours later, we got picked up by a PT boat, and they sent us back to Cairns. We got checked out and everything. So anyway, then I joined the 32nd Infantry Division, which was a Wisconsin National Guard. I joined the 126th Regiment. So we joined the 9th and 7th Australian divisions. They were freshly come back. They were called the Rats of Tobruk in the Middle East someplace. I don't know where.
Yeah, that's in Libya. And the rats of Tobruk are still legendary in Australia. About 14,000 Australian troops held off the Desert Fox, Erwin Rommel, from April to August of 1941. Rommel, at that point, had never been defeated, so this was a big deal. And these Australian forces dug a network of tunnels. They used them very effectively. That's thought to be some of the inspiration for that rats label. And when German propaganda broadcasts described them as caught like rats in a trap, they adopted that rat nickname. They even went so far as to make rat-shaped medals from the metal of a German bomber they shot down with German guns they had captured. The rats of Tobruk are a great chapter of World War II history before America was ever involved in the war. So these are the Australians that you were fighting alongside. They were already seasoned veterans, and you join up with these rats of Tobruk in New Guinea in 1942. Where'd you go?
We joined them crossing the Owen Stanley Range. We were on the way to Buna Gona, but we were on the Kokoda Trail, and there was nothing but couldn't carry trucks or anything like that, you know. It was all pulled by horses. So anyway, we weren't getting any supplies or anything, you know. So we ran out of food. We got a lot of malaria, dysentery, dengue fever, fighting all the elements. And we were hungry. So we started eating horse meat till we got to Kokoda. And then we went all the way to Buna Gona. And Buna and Gona were still held by the Japanese, and I think the Navy did a lot of bombarding and this and that, you know. When I got to Buna Gona, they asked for volunteers because I had been, you know, in the ocean, you know. There was a new outfit which was called Special Amphibious Brigades, so I joined the 2nd Amphibious Brigade. And that's when I started making landings, you know, landing troops on D-Day landings. So I was assigned to the 1st Marine Division. And we did a lot of small landings and some big landings, too. And we also supplied the Coast Watchers.
And there's another fascinating aspect of World War II that we really haven't discussed on this program, but you can read more about it if you pull up Mr. Paredes' story on hometownheroesradio.com. The Coast Watchers were a group of about 400 people from Australia, New Zealand, some of the other Pacific Islands, native tribesmen who operated behind enemy lines and helped the Allies in many ways. Maybe the most famous example was the Coast Watchers' involvement in the rescue of future President John F. Kennedy after the explosion of PT-109. Anyway, so supplying those Coast Watchers was a facet of your job with the 2nd Engineer Special Brigade. It sounds like pretty dangerous duty. And what happened next?
So anyway, one of my friends, he got caught by the Japanese and they beheaded him.
Where was that?
That was in New Guinea.
And I'm sure that had to be really hard for you to deal with. And it probably also tells you what would happen to you if you got caught, right?
That's it. You know, a lot of people don't believe that I ran into people, Japanese people, using babies in the Philippine Islands for bayonet practice. There's two Japanese people who pick up this kid, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years old, even babies, toss him up in the air, and the Japanese guy would come and stab him. And that was hard to do, to watch that, you know. So I remember one time in New Guinea, I got into a hand-to-hand combat with one. It was a boy, but I don't think he was 17 years old. And he wasn't, I don't know, maybe he was suicidal or whatever. But he did get me a little bit. But I said, sorry, but it's you or me. And I got him.
You mentioned making beach landings. What were the beach landings that you were involved in?
The one that I remember the most was in Cape Lasser, New Britain. We went in there with the 1st Marine Division and the 32nd Infantry Division, the 126th Regiment. We landed them, came back, took another load of Marines and infantry, took them in, and then we wait for people to bring dead and wounded. Then I pick up the dead and the wounded and take them to the hospital ship, which was, you know, laid out, you know, offshore. Take them, unload them, and then go back and get another load. It would be maybe 10, 12 trips.
On what? On a LCVP or?
They were LCMs. My number was 696. I'll never forget that because, you know, it got full of holes, you know, by machine gun fire, you know, but we made it all right.
Well, and you mentioned machine gun holes, and I know that that duty to bring out the dead and wounded had to be very taxing emotionally, but you mentioned machine gun holes, and you told me you were wounded three times during the war. Where were those three occurrences? Tell me about them.
Once I got wounded in New Guinea, and the one that was going to treat me, he was a medic. The Marines called him corpsman, you know, but yeah, we called him medics. Called a medic, and when he came out to take care of me, he got shot. I got picked up with somebody else, I don't know who, and they took me to a hospital. They sent me back to Australia. I was in the hospital in Australia for a while. They took care of me good, you know, and then they sent me back to my unit.
Tell me how you got hit. What was happening at the time? How did it all unfold?
It was a bonsai attack. Japanese, you know, they pulled a bonsai on you whenever they could.
So you're in a defensive position and all of a sudden a bullet from somewhere hits you? Where?
Oh, I got hit in the leg. In fact, I have a silver kneecap.
And then you call a medic and then he gets killed trying to help you out. I mean, what goes through your head in a situation like that? It sounds pretty desperate to me.
Yes, but I mean, you know, I says, this wound is going to send me home. No way. They needed us over there.
So that was the first time you were wounded. What was the second?
The second time was in the Philippine Islands. That was in Tacloban, Leyte. We landed in Tacloban, Leyte, and across was an island, Samar. And on my boat, I picked up a dead Japanese dead body in between the propellers. So I had to pull in the beach and tie my boat up, you know, and get under water and change propellers. But first chop the body out. It was tangled in both the propellers. So I chopped them out. In the meantime, while the guy was giving me oxygen in my mask, we get a raid, you know, and he pulled the cord, you know, told me that meant the signal for me to get up, you know. So a bomb hits, I'd say maybe 100, 150 feet, but the concussion on the water, you know, it hurt my ears. That's not when I got wounded. That's when I got up. When I got out, you know, and I was going to try getting my boat off the beach, so I manned my machine gun. And here comes a zero strafing, and one of the bullets got into the cockpit and went circled, you know, round and round, and it hit me here, went around, hit the well deck, yeah. I mean the cockpit, hit another one. And then I got another one back here.
So you got hit on the right rib cage and in the left side of your back, kind of almost simultaneously.
But I mean, that Japanese zero didn't last very long. Because the Navy was there, you know, and the Air Force were there. In fact, I'm lucky that I got out of there because there was bullets flying all over the damn place.
Well, yeah, and it seems to me if you get hit on your side and in your back, there's a lot of organs in there that could have been damaged by that. You're probably pretty fortunate to have survived that.
Right. So anyway, I did get my third wound.
Well, let's finish up the second one first. How bad was it? How much pain were you in? And
I was in a lot of pain, you know, but I had, you know, some sulfanilamide powder, and I had a bandage, you know, had a first aid kit, and I had morphine, give a shot, you know.
You had to take care of yourself.
I took care of myself, yes. Took care of my wounds and I was fine.
Did you at all consider the possibility that you might not make it out of that?
Yes. I said maybe this is my time to go. But the big boy up there, you know, he took care of me.
It sure sounds like it. And so that was in the Philippines on Leyte. And then you said a third time you were wounded. Where was that and how'd that happen?
The third time was in the Philippines again. that was in Ormoc, you know, that was across the Tacloban on the other end of the island.
Ormoc, sir, there's a big horseshoe kind of bay there, right?
Yeah, right. So I got wounded there too. The same thing, you know, on the boat, you know, and.
So you're still operating this LCM, and it was aircraft fire again?
Yes. When I got wounded there, I landed on the beach and I dug in. My LCM, you know, was broached. Couldn't pull it out. So I had to abandon it, went on the beach, and then I dug a hole, you know, in the sand, and then a bomb fell about maybe, but from here to my van, and I got blown up in the air about maybe 15, 18 feet. And I come back down, and then on the way down, I got hit with a piece of shrapnel right here.
Right under your chin. So the bomb hits 50 feet away, you go sky high, and on your way down, something slices you on the top of your neck, just bottom of your chin?
The doctor, he says, Sergeant, he says, I can't operate on you because it's too close to your jugular vein. Says eventually, hopefully, it's going to travel, and it's going to travel away from your jugular vein. So when I got out about maybe 40 years later, I started getting a toothache.
I think everybody can tell where this is going, but we need to take a break. So hold that thought. Francisco Paredes, 94 years old, quite a story, and we're not done with it yet. We'll pick it up in the dentist chair when we come back. If you want to check out photos of Mr. Paredes and even a video where he shows you the different places he was wounded, hop on to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.
I'm really trying to redefine the hearing aid in general. Today's modern hearing aid is vastly different from your father's or grandfather's hearing aid.
Nathan Leff, owner of Sound Advice, with an eye-opener for our ears.
We've got hearing aids now that are directly linked to iPhones. You can stream phone calls directly from your iPhone to your hearing devices without any intermediate piece at all. If you're on a jog and you want to listen to music, you stream music directly from your phone to your hearing device.
Sound Advice, with new innovative products and the best possible care by a licensed hearing aid professional.
Well, I'll be happy to give somebody a consultation. There's no cost to that. I'll give you all the different price points and then shop around, because you have to find not only a device that suits you, but a provider that suits you as well.
Begin your quest for better hearing. Call Sound Advice at 579-1310 or visit online at hearingaidsfresno.com.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 94-year-old Francisco Paredes of Atwater, California, originally from Arizona, where he grew up as one of 16 children, 16, in one Mescalero Apache family. He joined the Army before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and served until after the Japanese surrendered. We've heard about the three different times he was wounded while serving in the Pacific. The third time, a tiny piece of shrapnel from a bomb caught him underneath the chin. Too close to his jugular vein to operate, doctors then told him to expect that little scrap of metal to migrate away from the jugular over time. And right before we left off, he described developing a severe toothache 40 years later. So this is in the 1980s now. And what happened next?
So I went to the dentist. He took x-rays. He said, you got a piece of metal, he says, in your root canal. Says your tooth has got to be pulled. So he pulled it. And sure as heck, there's a little chip of shrapnel.
So 40 years later, this little, how big would you say, like fingernail size piece of shrapnel?
I'd say about half of a match hit on the matchstick. Okay. It's just a little chip.
He pulls that out of your mouth 40 years later. That you must have gotten quite the kick out of that.
My wife got a kick out of it.
A lot of times when I hear these kind of stories from veterans, they then pull out the piece of shrapnel and show it to me. But I'm guessing if it was that small, maybe you didn't hang on to it?
No. I didn't want that as a souvenir. That's why I have 12 shoppers now.
Uh-huh. When you think about that, I mean, I'm just adding it up. You survive the Pearl Harbor attacks. You end up in a B-25 bomber for one mission and get shot down and survive that, then you're wounded in the leg, you're hit in the ribs and the back, then you're hit near your jugular vein, yet I look at you now and you're about the healthiest 94-year-old I can imagine. How in the world does all that happen? Is it hard for you to even believe?
It is very hard for me to believe. You know, a lot of younger people. In fact, I just had two friends that, you know, they just passed away. Well, I say, you know, young people, because one was 88 and the other one was 82. And they just passed away, you know. And, I don't know.
I know you said earlier you credited your Native American heritage, Mescalero Apache. You mentioned that the big boy upstairs helped you out in that case. But when you think about everything you've been through and the fact that you're still here, you ever wonder why? If there's a reason for all of that?
Yes, I think so. See, I do a lot of volunteer work. Like, I volunteer over here.
At the VFW post?
VFW post. Uh-huh. It's not very hard work, you know. I help them set up for hamburger night. I help them set up, you know, for breakfast on Sundays. I water the lawn. I do a lot of, you know, picayune stuff. I'm also a member of the county honor guard. It gives me a peace of mind, you know, to help do, you know, volunteer work. I also volunteer for senior citizens, AARP, you name it, they need me. And I also do lectures in schools, churches, and I tell these kids, go to school, get an education, stay away from cigarettes, gangs, graffiti, and dope. Those are killers. They're not, you know, I've been through a lot of people, and my last deal that I tell them is this, I've been through a lot, you know, in my life, but I never saw John Wayne in Iwo Jima, and I never saw him in Guadalcanal. I never saw him any place.
And you were at all those places?
No, not really, but I was in Bella La Bella. I was in Bougainville, Saipan, Tarawa. My last one was Iwo Jima.
And your brother was at Iwo Jima. In fact, you have some documentation that he was one of the first five people to make the top of Suribachi?
Yeah, my brother, Raul, to me, he was my hero because he never got credit for what he did. And Paul over here, he has it documented by some of his people, you know.
Yeah, let me try to explain that a little bit for our listeners. This is your brother, Raul. I have a picture of him on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. He's no longer with us, but he and four others were the first Americans to summit Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima. We've all seen that photo of the flag raising on top of the mountain. Joe Rosenthal took it, one of the most famous photographs of all time. And you've probably heard, perhaps even on this program, if you've been paying attention, that photo was actually the second flag atop the summit. But one of the neat things about doing this show is that I always learn new things about World War II. And Frank's brother, Raul, is part of this one. Before either flag made it to the top of Mount Suribachi, Raul Paredes and four others had volunteered for dangerous duty, and they'd been ordered to scale that rocky volcano and find a cave that the Japanese were firing from. They had to go up in the dark of night, and they succeeded. More importantly, they survived. And a few hours after they did that, that first flag went up atop Mount Suribachi, brought by another patrol. So your brother had a very historic role on Iwo Jima, but you survived a lot during World War II, and we've heard quite a few of those stories. But eventually you got to come home from the war, to come back to America again. You're in from the start to the finish of U.S. involvement in World War II. So what was it like to come home, to see America again, and know that even at a very heavy cost, freedom had prevailed over tyranny?
I came home in 1946 because before I came home, I joined the 6th Division chasing down a general that had gone to Korea. So we chased him down. We didn't catch him. Another outfit, part of the 6th Division, caught him. But we got 3 unit citations for that. So then I came home. I tried to get a job. Couldn't find a job. I had a 1940 Chevrolet Cab Coupe. I had it in storage, but the tires were stolen. I couldn't get no tires for it. I couldn't get no clothes. I couldn't get a job. So I waited 6 months, and then I joined the National Guard, and at the time, the Korean War was starting to, to develop. So then they sent me to back to the Philippines, and from there to Japan. So when the Korean War broke out, I went to Korea. They airlifted me to Busan, and they put me in the tanks. I didn't know apples about tanks, but I had to learn real fast, you know. So they gave me a tank, but you couldn't very well use them on account of the snow. They had snow, believe it or not, 18 to 24 feet of snow. You try running a tank in the snow like that, your traction, you'll go deeper and deeper. So anyway, I spent a lot of time in caves, but I did get to go to as far as a chosen reservoir. Truman fired MacArthur. So anyway, they got orders to retreat, not to go as far as the 38th parallel. So one of those generals says, we retreat, hell, we're going to advance to the rear. And that's what we did.
It's a pretty good euphemism, isn't it? Did you have some other close calls over there in Korea? And how long were you there?
I was in Korea for, I'd say, till 2 days before the war ended, you know. My knees started acting up. You know, I had a cap already.
From your first wound in World War II?
Yeah, and then I couldn't move my leg. It froze. So anyway, they sent me to Fitzsimmons General Hospital in Denver. And I was there for about 3 months. Incidentally, I have a frostbite too. And they treated that, you know, and I got my discharge there. And then they sent me home. When I got home, there was one friend of mine that got killed right in front of me. I promised him that I would go visit his family if I made it. So that's what I did. You know, when I got home, I went to Anthony, New Mexico, and met Frank Chavez's family. His brother was a Senator Dennis Chavez of New Mexico at the time, and that was the hardest thing I had to do. I went and told him, you know, this is a message from your son. He died like a man, and he died a hero. So in Denver, before I got my discharge, this recruiter, you know, recruiting sergeant, he said, if you stay in, we'll give you another stripe. I said, wait a minute. I says, what will I be doing? He says, you will be delivering bodies all over the country. I says, no, thank you. I'm out of here.
And what brought you to Atwater? How long you been here? How'd you end up here?
I ended up here. I came to Monterey. I started putting my life together. I started fishing again. Nah, not for me. I said, I'm going to try something different. So I went into bricklaying, and that's what I retired as a bricklayer. I did it for 40 years.
And I guess the other thing I need to know when I think about this and everything that you survived, when did you meet your wife? Because it sounds like you had to survive a whole lot just to have the chance to meet her.
I went to Mexico. And I met my wife, bless her heart. I was 39 years old already, and she was 23, but she was adopted. You know, she was an orphan, and she had an adopted mother, you know. But they treated her like a slave. She was doing everything for everybody in the family. So one of my cousins there in Mexico told me, why don't you take Artemisa and marry her? I says, I don't know. I says, because, you know, she's a young girl, and I'm an old man already. She says, I think she likes you. So we start, you know, dating. In the meantime, I was in the fire department in Monterey, California. I went on vacation, and I told her adopted mother, I said, okay, if you don't let me marry her, I'm going to do it the old Indian way. We're going to elope. She didn't go for that. So anyway, I took a leave of absence from the fire department. Went down there. I said, okay. I said, here I am. Are we or aren't we going to get married? So the old lady said, okay, you're gonna get married, all right. But you're going to have to get married in Mexico, and then you're going to have to get married in the United States. Make it legal in both countries. So that's what we did.
Before I run out of time, let me ask you about Honor Flight. What was it like for you to go on this plane with all these other veterans and go see that World War II memorial?
To me, it was beautiful. We were treated like royalty. We had the best of everything. But one thing, you know, I stole a pen from the Hilton Hotel. But I left $5 there. And they owe me $5 because the pen fell apart on me.
That's funny. And you got to do that with your daughter. What was that like to be able to have that whole trip and all those memorials that you saw and the other veterans you met and to share that with her?
Well, a lot of that she didn't believe, you know. But what got me the most, you know, because as a rule, I was Army, but mostly, you know, I feel myself being a Marine because most of my, you know, was with the Marines. So the Marine Memorial reminded me of my brother, my friends, the people that I knew in the Marine Corps, and especially the Code Talkers. The other one was Arlington National Cemetery, because I have two people, real good friends of mine, buried there. One is Junior Vinvois. He got killed in New Guinea. He got the Medal of Honor. And the other one was a real, real good friend of mine, Frank Chavez. He got the Medal of Honor, too, from Anthony, New Mexico.
And you told us how you had to go and tell his family about that. Being around all those other veterans, I know you're around a lot of veterans here at the VFW all the time, but having that trip with 70 other World War II veterans or around that number, did you make some new friends? Did that add to your experience?
I made a lot of new friends, but I mean, most of them on wheelchairs, you know, and not me. Right now, you know, I'm a little, you know, because I twisted my ankle.
You were up on a ladder and fell a little bit?
I was up putting up a window air conditioner. And I asked for help, you know, but nobody would come and help me, you know. So anyway, I said, I can do it.
And you're still driving?
Oh, yes.
What else do you do with yourself at 94?
I do a lot of volunteer work, mostly.
When you think about your children and your grandchildren and just all the people that you meet here in Atwater, because like you say, you volunteer a lot and you're around a lot of folks. What do you want them to know about World War II, about you and your brothers and the guys who felt like brothers and what all of you did back then? Why was it important to remember that today?
I would like to have, being that there was four of us brothers in the military during World War II, I would like to have them put in a VFW magazine, like, you know, they do that for brothers, you know, in the same. Yeah. I would love that, you know.
We'll see if we can do that. And the one other thing, you mentioned the Code Talkers. Did you have direct interactions with them during the war?
I met them with the 1st Marine Division.
So you felt like you had a special connection to them being Native Americans?
Yeah. So anyway, I did a powwow last year here at Table Mountain Casino. It was for all Native American World War II veterans. And incidentally, I was the oldest one and the only Apache warrior there. And I got honored for that.
As well you should. Well, Mr. Paredes, I just want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for sharing so much of your one-of-a-kind story with us today. And don't lose that spunk. Frank Paredes of Atwater, California. His buddies at the VFW there get a kick out of his hat and all the pins that he has on it related to his service in World War II in Korea. He also has a pin that has nothing to do with the Army but might be the best conversation piece. And you can find a little video of him explaining all of that on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. If you didn't get enough of his personality in this last hour, you'll get a little bit more there. We're out of time on Hometown Heroes for today. I hope you'll join us again next time. And until then, I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that freedom is not free.